Today we are speaking with Gemma Blessert. She's well on her way to obtain the Certified Technical Architect status and is also the CEO of ladiesbearchitects.com and the Architect Club. Gemma's focused primarily on helping others succeed, and this has also surfaced through our conversation, as you will see. The questions that Emmerich and I have posed are very closely related to a Salesforce consultant's work approach, and I'm glad that this conversation itself can be a helping hand for those of you out there consulting. And without further ado, we bring you Gemma Blessert.
I fell into Salesforce as an administrator, and it only took me about a year of working for an end user before I wanted to go and actually help other companies with it, because I also wanted to extend my knowledge and use more areas and configure more areas on the platform as well. So I went off to do some consultancy, worked for a couple of boutiques, then eventually took the opportunity to work on some more detailed projects with kind of rose through the ranks, if you like, from doing small quick starts right the way up until doing big rollouts, maybe 200 to 300 users, and then progressing into the enterprise space. It was around that time that I got involved with Financial Force, about 2011. They purchased their PSA tool from Aperio and agreed to take it on and productize it. And I was one of the first consultants in Europe to implement it. So quite enjoyed working with it. It was complicated, but it was a real teeth cutter. And it didn't take me long to... I went off to Capgemini, and it didn't take me long to actually accept a job at Financial Force after a while, focusing primarily on Financial Force product. Whilst I was at Financial Force, I was probably the only consultant who had a real background working with Salesforce, doing sales and service cloud. So I was able to provide that holistic approach whenever we work with customers to help them see the value of all of the other solutions that they could get, as well as the Financial Force managed packages. And after a period of ill health, I came back and started working on more complicated projects where I had to string together various different packages for public sector quite often. I worked with the FCA, I worked with the National Audit Office in the UK, both really successful projects and huge programs. And really enjoyed it. And I started to realize that my interests weren't just in doing sales, service, community, Financial Force. I was more interested in the strategic impact that the whole platform has on those organizations. And to be able to take the NAO, for example, from having all these spreadsheets for new starters that then get pinged around the building to various other resource managers so that they can get staffed onto audit projects, you know, taking them down from all those spreadsheets right down to having HR just set up one worker and it just ping everything off around the rest of the system automatically was quite a motivator for me. It saved weeks of admin and really gave some value there. So that was around that time I discovered my future desired career path. I didn't want to be a project manager. I also knew that I wasn't really consulting at a pure system integrator level either. I was looking at the big picture. Mm-hmm. And I looked for a job as a solution architect at Blue Wolf and was accepted. Had a great mentor, very motivating environment for me, lots of really good people, lots of fun, and a really fantastic engagement program that really gave me a bit more direction in where I wanted to go. I knew I wanted to do Salesforce, and I knew I wanted to, I was more interested in how solutions strung together, but I wasn't interested in doing development. And I wanted to just get some more experience wherever I could, really. So Blue Wolf presented that opportunity. I decided to use my bench time really carefully and caught up on some certifications. And I went from being 5 times certified when I joined Blue Wolf to being 16 times certified about 6 to 7 months later, and then working towards my CTA. It was around that time I didn't really want to study by myself. So I founded Ladies Be Architects, which was initially just who else is here that's female or not male and would like to do the CTA path or at least try and get some of the way there. And I didn't expect it to have momentum. It did, but we went to about 4,000 followers, participants around the world, which is roughly what we have right now. So it's been a bit of a roller coaster the last couple of years. I've been ill again since, had a major operation, but I started to get more involved in the Salesforce community and wanted to support other people on their career paths. And And it really messed with my head in a fantastic way. So I've now started my own independent advisory consultancy that focuses on Salesforce and works with partners and other people to implement for customers, but with us just kind of holding a hand and making sure the requirements make sense and all of that, making sure the customer knows what they're getting. And I'm really enjoying it. It's the best thing I could have done. So probably took about 5 to 7 minutes, but that's just...
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, no problem. I was going to say, there are a few nuggets that you threw there, which are a few kind of key names like Financial Force. You also mentioned, you know, the managed packages there. I really want to understand, you know, how would someone kind of think about that whenever they, you know, they need to implement a multi-package, you know, project in a multinational or anything like that. How do you actually think about a solution? You know, how do you map that out? But in the same time, before we kind of get to the details of the project, I do want to kind of touch upon in terms of, you know, people getting into the Salesforce community. I mean, for example, we can slightly relate here, you know, for example, with Veo. I basically said, you know, I'm working on this, you know, I'm kind of doing interesting things. I like it. I think you should have a look at it. And that kind of had a bit of a domino effect. And, you know, right now he's trying to kind of do the same thing for other people in his circle. So it is kind of, in a way, yeah, like a domino effect. You kind of, you know, one person after the other.
Avalanche of change,
Correct. Avalanche of change.
Yeah, that's positive change, yeah.
I can't take credit for that. I was on a panel and one of the girls in the panel came out with that.
Yeah. But what that's I was going to say, from your point of view, in case you do not have this network around you that potentially someone in there is involved with Salesforce and is the first time that they hear about it, they potentially hear about the packages, the salaries that are out there, they potentially hear about the growth and the need for these consultants or specialists. How would you try to do kind of an elevator pitch type of motivational sentence for someone to say, I think you should get into this and this is how you should do it?
Wow, how do you even do that? There's been a conversation on Twitter today. Because, I mean, last night I was on my YouTube channel adding some stuff because I'm doing some free training at the moment. So I was uploading that to YouTube and I noticed some comments around another video that we did at Ladies of the Architects around sharing architecture. And a comment was made around, will this channel help me pass the exam? And I was like, okay, how much Gemma emotion are we going to throw into this? So we kind of took a step back. This isn't abnormal. There's a bit of a, it's an interesting mixed barrel of attitudes out there when it comes to things. But I actually wrote back and said, what's more important in your world, the exam or the knowledge? And they said, the exam. And the ensuing Twitter conversation that was started last night and continued through the night as the Americans were finishing work for the day.
Yeah.
Sleeping. There was a real mixed view. You know, there were some people that said, you know, I've been working with a CRM for sort of 10 years and they turned down a job because I didn't have a certification. And I said, well, in that case, actually they've missed out because I would have looked at your CV and I would have and seen all of that. And I would have probably still interviewed you and sponsored you to get the exam, right? Because if you've got the experience behind you, it doesn't matter. You know, the exam is a piece of paper in terms of its meaning, but I'm not going to undermine the study and the hard work that goes into preparing for the exam and understanding why that's the right answer when you're in there. So I think in terms of getting into the industry, it helps if you have a certification, because it shows the willingness and drive to go and own your own future. But at the same time, I think there's a lot to be said for employers. Employers need to be really clear about what their views are around the value of certifications, especially given the fact that there are people out there selling dumps, which is completely immoral to me. And you know, there were obviously red flags. If someone turned up in front of me with 5 certs and only a year's worth of experience, I would actually think, okay, you're academically gifted, but, you know, tell me about what you've done for this last year is what I would want to know.
Yeah, well, there's probably an easy answer. I studied for exams, which that is not really everything when it comes to that. And
But then if someone has done that and then they've got 20 years of IT experience behind them, I'm not as likely to write them all off. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If somebody's brand new, entry level, completely, I've heard that I can make lots and lots of money doing Salesforce, so I'm just going to study my backside off and get all these certifications. You know, it's not about how many certifications you've got. When you're assessing a candidate, it's, can I put them in front of my stakeholders? Am I confident that if I give them something to do, they're going to ask why, like the business reason why, and they're not just going to blindly do it? Some of that comes with experience, but it's also about attitudes as well. So I've lost count of the amount of orgs I've logged into where it's just, you know, somebody's got excited because they got admin certified and they're like, I'm going to make a workflow, I'm going to make a Visualforce page, I'm going to make this. And you realize, oh God, I've got to strip all that back now. So much technical debt, so much over engineering. You know, it's attitude. That's not really an elevator pitch.
It's not really an elevator pitch. No. But what I was going to say is, you know, it is actually quite important for whoever is kind of planning to move or is planning to advance a career in Salesforce. It's probably the realistic view of this. It's you know, you can't really quote unquote kind of buy your way to the top with a number of certifications, because, you know, if you were to do that for a brand new client that is just hiring you off the back of a job post and they have no knowledge of that, you may not even, you know, get in there. But when it comes to interacting with other Salesforce partners, other Salesforce professionals, it's quite obvious. So it may be kind of a downside to your quote unquote reputation, or, you know, the credibility that you bring into the team.
There's that, but it's also not playing God with someone else's investment. The companies are investing hundreds of thousands of pounds in some instances to go live with Salesforce because they can see the value of it.
Mm.
But they have to try, they can't look after it themselves. They need to get people in who know stuff and, or at least are prepared to be methodical about how they're going to support their users. So for me, I think the most successful candidates are the ones that show that willingness to learn, that have good listening skills, that are confident enough to have conversations with customers customers and stakeholders and really tease out the details and not jump straight to solutions, but to actually listen very carefully to what's the value. Prime example is for me, an admin, it's very easy for an admin to take a request from a user who says, can you make me a checkbox? And they just go, yeah, here you go. Look how easy it is. Look how talented I am that I can make you this checkbox really quickly. But actually the talent comes in saying, well, why do you think it's a checkbox? Tell me, why have you come to me with a solution? Tell me what problem you're trying to solve. And so you find out that actually people just want a flag to flag something. And it's either an education opportunity where you can say, well, actually, we're already tracking that and it's important for the reporting that you do it this way. Oh, we don't actually have that in place yet. Could you explain more about the decisions that are going to be made from the reporting that you drive off this checkbox? And are there any other systems that need to know about this checkbox being ticked? Are there any automated processes that need to be kicked off by this checkbox? Is there any code that you know could fall over because of this checkbox? How do we deploy it? Do we have a structured way of deploying between sandboxes, et cetera, et cetera? So it becomes a much bigger conversation and people are, oh, for God's sake, I just wanted a checkbox.
Yeah, and oftentimes I think people have an idea of what they need, but a real Salesforce person will know exactly what is better for their actual need. Mm-hmm. And that's where that kind of thinking comes in. So makes sense.
I've heard of, I think a lot of people have heard of the mandatory checkbox. You know, you have a mandatory, oh, we need a mandatory checkbox. Well, actually, there's only one option for that. It's mandatory. It's true.
It's mandatory thing. People want it to be filled out. You want to pick this, it's yes or no. And even then, that's not the best.
Yeah.
So it's really being able to lift off the covers and look underneath to see exactly what value is being driven by that. And that's one of the first things I was taught as an administrator.
Well, I was going to say, because when it comes to consulting and when it comes to projects, you I'm presuming here, but you will have kind of presumably kind of two sides, you know, one when you're potentially kind of implementing a project and you're part of the team. So you're an internal member, and one when you're kind of doing the consulting side. So you're brought in via a partner. And I think that's the part that I'm more kind of interested in, because, you know, when it comes to consultancies, you know, you may work on two or three different projects kind of in the same time or in parallel, that type of thing. So the key will be for any consultant to be able kind of to switch complexities and you know, switch attitudes towards stakeholders and projects. But I was going to say, in terms of starting a project, you know, however that comes about, you know, some salesperson has closed an opportunity or so on, it doesn't really matter. When it comes to starting that, what would be kind of the mindset of actually getting into that first kickoff meeting or anything like that? How would you approach that? Or how do you approach that?
First of all, as what I always end up having to do is I go and tell the salesperson off for not selling any prep time.
Mm.
Because I've got a utilization target to hit, and this project can't be successful without any prep time. So that's a conversation to have with the project manager, and for the project manager to kind of put in. And often what ends up happening is, shut up, Gemma, it is what it is. This is the statement of work that's been sold. You have to stick with what's been sold. So the best thing you can do as a consultant is to print off the statement of work. Don't keep it hidden away in your Mac. Because if you print it off, you've got it to hand and you can go through and check things. The second thing you have to do is plan your workshops. Go through that statement of work and align your discovery workshops to the topics that are in scope. And be very familiar with the out of scope items as well before you go in, because the customer is going to forget or may not have been involved, because typically these sales cycles are quite long. So between saying, yes, we're going to go ahead and starting, it could be like 6 weeks in some situations, by which point the business has moved along, things have changed, and they, you know, the statement of work is still valid, but maybe some bits have, you know, bent a little bit. So know that you are going to have to dig a bit deeper than what's in the statement of work, but use the statement of work to guide you and keep you on track in terms of your meetings and then how you structure your requirements capture. The second thing is, have a plan of how you're going to, and a structure of how you're going to collect these requirements. Personally, I do not write specs anymore. There is no point in writing an 80-page document because customers aren't going to read it. Simple as. But we tend to do them because they cover our backsides, because inevitably a customer is going to argue with you when they get the invoice, or when you get down to testing, or when you get to go live, that you've missed something. And in some situations, you could have missed something because you just haven't thought about it. In which case you can introduce peer review processes to make sure that you've covered all of those during the analysis phase. But also they'll, you know, it could be that it's perhaps taken a little bit longer to do the work, and the customer wants to maybe try and claw back some hours because they've got more they want you to do. I would say, if once you're familiar with that scope, don't be afraid to argue and defend it. Because if you're a consultant working in a delivery team, your project manager is the one that is responsible for delivering the project on time, to budget, and to in scope. So, but they don't have psychic powers. If you're not around, or, you know, it can come down to very simple things like, these are the dates I'm going on holiday. These are the dates I'm planning to do an exam. These are the dates where World Tour is, and I plan to take my customer along to it. It's around, you are just as responsible as a consultant to set expectations with your project manager as your project manager is responsible for setting expectations with your customer. Sometimes that means having a tough conversation and actually pushing back. You know, I've seen people who have needed to go, who've, you know, arranged to go to World Tour, and then they've been told by their project manager, no, you're not going, got to do work because the customer wants you. And actually, I think what could have happened is that proactive engagement to say, World Tour's happening, there's a lot you can learn, come along with us. You know, we'll host you, et cetera, and we'll show you around to some of the breakout sessions and help you apply it to this project. And that will help to build that confidence with the customer as well, and build that trust. And at that point, you're not having to basically miss out on valuable experiences just because you've got to do client work. Take the client with you. You know, it's simple things like that. And have that can-do attitude around it as well. But going back to the project management side as well, I have had to juggle several projects at once. And I've had weeks where I've been in London for 2 days. And then on the Tuesday night, I've flown out to Amsterdam or to Germany. And I've done 2 or 3 days with a different client in Germany. And then I've had to come back and go back to London on the Friday. Those projects, that model is really not, for me, I found that really tough because you've got no prep time in between. So you can easily forget which clients you're working on. And you know what? You can say no to a project, or you can say, I'll do this, but I need you to do this for me, because it's going to, and actually explain why meeting in the middle and having that compromise is going to make the project more successful and de-risk the project.
Yeah. I mean, kind of closest thing that I could probably relate to that. I did a project once. It was kind of, I was doing something for like the north of England. They have, this kind of purchasing group that I was implementing a purchasing related, system. So I was in Sheffield on Monday. I was in Durham on Tuesday. Completely different, you know, purpose and planning. And in Sheffield was basically a full day. And then you travel, you get to the hotel, you know, kind of you're tired already. And then Durham was in the morning for a different meeting. And then from there, I took the train back and went to London. So those were basically 3 days with 3 different projects, 3 different clients. I will say I was probably not on my A game.
That's the thing. I mean, we would often say that is just hashtag consultant life, but you know, that it doesn't have to be like that. Because typically in a consultancy project, if you're not billable, you're not making any money for the customer, for your company.
Yeah.
And that's why you have utilization targets, because you have to have a certain amount of level of utilization in order to pay your way.
I was going to say, in regards to that, because I've heard of this before, and correct me if I don't know, you may have a different opinion or may know different than me, but from what I understand, the average of that is about 70%. Is that correct? Or
Between 70 and 80, yes, I would
say. Between 70 and 80, yeah.
Personally, I am not a fan of utilization as a metric or as a target. I understand why people put it in. It's to do with billability and profit and all of that kind of stuff. I believe it's a business metric. I don't believe it's something that you personally should be held accountable for alone. Having consulted across many professional services businesses, you know, the arguments for having utilization targets is that if you are not billable, then you can go and get some, you can go and help each other to become billable. But then that also creates complication for the project managers, because it's like, well, I can only give you a certain number of hours because I need to keep them from the people that are actually assigned to the project. And it becomes that awful conversation. You know, it happened to me last year where I was too expensive to be utilized, really. But I was offering to help people and doing like a week's worth of work and then being told I could only log 4 hours for it, and then being penalized because I hadn't hit my utilization target. So when I started the architect club, I said, enough's enough. We're not doing utilization. Simple as. We are just not doing it.
Yeah. Because I have heard of situations where I was probably about like 2.5 years ago, I was scouting for a job, to be honest. And there were a few things on LinkedIn, et cetera. And then what I've learned is always look for reviews when it comes to companies. So I think it's Glassdoor that I went, and there were a lot of people in there saying that these guys are setting extremely impossible targets for utilization, and also are selling impossible number of days. Correct. Yeah. So they would say, you know, they will sell 20 days when actually the project would take about 35 on a shoestring.
Honestly, I've seen it happen so much because there's this fear among founders that it's like, well, if I don't bring the price down, they're not going to buy, and I need them to buy so that I can look good with Salesforce, they can give me more leads, you know, I can grow the business. But actually, you'll find that if you do a decent enough job, they'll book you again.
Something that you mentioned there, that you're not doing requirement or specification documents anymore. So probably related to that, I was kind of two things that probably kind of fall or are linked or probably kind of are meant to be asked, quote unquote, kind of together. So one thing would be business processes, because, you know, presumably that is something that you do need to understand in order to know exactly what you're delivering. But in the same time, I know there's this debate about who defines what we're doing. Is it technology or is it the business and all of that? But my question is, at one point in time, you do need to translate the business process into technology. So how does that work? How do you do that? Presumably, like in terms of tools or approaches, depending on how you actually do development, you may use Agile or all of that, or Scrums, et cetera. So how do you work with that?
So first of all, with methodologies, I don't believe that a one-size-fits-all. There are some companies that really struggle to adopt Agile principles. Like you give them a bunch of user stories and they go, you've not done the work. Where's my big document? You know, this isn't very Prince 2. Yeah. Where's the analysis? Where's the design? Where's the build? Where's the deployment? You know, and I just want you to go away at the end when it's done. And the thing with Salesforce is it's never finished.
So
as an architect in particular, you have to consider what is going to be the best delivery model for this customer to get the very best out of them and the best out of the team. So, similarly, some places really struggle with waterfall. Like you try and take them like a phased approach and it's like, you mean I've got to wait 4 months to get something? So, and it just doesn't land well. The way I handle this is I'm very pictorial. I use Lucidchart. I've used Lucidchart now for about 6 years. And over the years, I've developed a way of working with it that means somebody talks, I ask the question, I put a box on the page with an arrow going to the next box. That then informs my next question because I can think on my feet. And when I'm speaking, I tend to go through a process. That's what speaking is for me, is a mental process. So if someone is giving me a requirement like, I normally open up with a simple open-ended question. Who, what, where, why, when, and why, and how, sorry. And it starts with a simple question like, tell me how you calculate how many hours somebody has done on a piece of work. And they just go, boom, off they go. And if you're on a call, it's quite easy, for me anyway, to open up Lucidchart, share it, and just draw as they go. And then at some point, and then I kind of play back a little bit. Okay, so you're telling me that, you know, there is a timesheet. So that's an entity. So I know someone, how do they put that timesheet in? Well, they get a piece of paper. Okay, and somebody designed this form. Yes, somebody's designed this form. We've had it for 20 years. Okay, tell me what goes on the form. Well, they put in the number of hours, they put in the date, they put in some notes. Okay, tell me about how you calculate your margin on your project based on this timesheet. Well, we have a cost rate. Okay, what goes into the cost rate? Well, we have overheads and we have salaries and everything else. Okay, do you have a blend? Do you have like an average, or do you go down to like the payroll level? And then this conversation starts to come out. And in your head, you're starting to think, how does all this fit together? And I'm a very visual thinker, so this is just my approach. So they will talk and I will draw. And before you know it, you've got massive, like, okay, this is what happens when. So then I'll add another layer on and say, okay, tell me about the systems that are involved in this. And before you know it, I've got a system landscape. Then tell me more about, like, what systems are going to be going, what are coming, what's the policy around integration. You know, tell me a little bit more. Tell me is my favorite opener, because tell me is not a what.
Correct, yeah, yeah. Two things I wanted to kind of query on that is, so in terms of using this approach, basically you are building your object model in the same time.
Yeah.
You're building that. So you're taking kind of not really a shortcut, but you're kind of, you know, building as with them. The one thing I was going to say with that, you probably had this before, because you said, well, you know, kind of give me this information or tell me this information. And what I've had a number of times is, you know, we prepped for a workshop, we're there. And we get to a point where it's like, oh, well, there's a form.
Mm-hmm.
And I turn and say, where is the form?
Yeah, so it goes on the actions log.
Okay, so things like that, you kind of keep an action log of, okay, these haven't been sent or have been referenced but not provided.
So typical artifacts that I will produce, if I'm in a room with people, I'm wanting flip charts. I will flip chart the hell out of. I actually quite strategic about where I sit in rooms as well. When I come into a meeting room, the first thing I'm looking for is the flip chart, because then I'll park myself in front of it, because then I'm not tripping over bags or computers or cables or anything to get to the flip chart that I inevitably know I'm going to need. The same with whiteboards. I always take my own pens with me because you can never be certain about who's
correct. Yeah. Up.
So I have a pencil case. It's just full of pens. I take my own post-its. If people are discussing a topic and they're not sure of, you know, what agreement they're going to have, I'll give them post-its and an activity. And I'll say, I'll draw out a framework on a flip chart and ask them to write things down on the post-its and go and post it where they think it goes. Because that helps me and it gets them engaged, gets them up and walking around. But the way that I plan these workshops is very much in alignment with the statement of work. That's why we need 2 to 3 days to plan this out as a team, as to who's going to facilitate what activities are we going to complete, what else are we going to need to discuss with them. And actually, Blue Wolf gave me this amazing thing here, which I'm keeping forever, which, you know, is really interesting. It has some information about the kind of games that you can play to get information out of people. World Style Cafe is a good one. And then there are little tips in here about overcoming nerves, nonverbal communication, how to handle side conversations, drawing and using visual aids, all of these things. This is how you can actually make your customer is expecting to be bored when they come to these meetings. Oh, I've got an all-day workshop. It's going to be really boring and really intense. Yet your brain will hurt at the end of it, but it will actually stick with you because people remember more. They make stronger memories and associations when they're moving around at the same time. So if you can engage them in physical activities that are productive because they give you the requirements you need, they won't forget that. They'll go back, oh my God, this workshop was so good. So fun. So yeah. They don't forget that. You don't forget it, because actually sometimes when you've got requirements that you're not sure of, you can think, okay, where was I standing in the room when that happened? Oh, I was talking to this person and then they said that, so that's the person I need to ask. But alongside all of this drawing and activities, I know I've gone all over the place on this, but it's because I get very enthusiastic about it. The key artifacts I'm producing might result in a data model, result in a process flow diagram that often does, which maps the as is, and a requirements matrix. And in that requirements matrix, in order to clarify those, I'm writing them out as user stories. I'm putting any high level comments, but I'm also saying to the customer, okay, you say you want to have a solution for configuring a quote and adding these different bundles and having different prices on them and stuff. What's the minimum level, you know, what's the least you expect it to do? And they go, da-da-da-da-da. Okay, what does really good look like? Tell me what really good looks like. And guess what? You're building your test script.
Wow, I never thought of that. It makes sense. It does make sense. I always thought, because when it comes to the test scripts, I did something for an NHS or a kind of trust where we did that, and I was actually trying. I was basically kind of putting some test scripts, and it wasn't really. It was more like functional test scripts, just to validate that, you know, the package actually worked and all of that. To present that to them, to give them the opportunity to test that. But then I was thinking, I'm not exactly sure what they're expecting, because, you know, I know what I would, but I'm biased. I cannot do that.
It's your job to find out what they're expecting, and also to find out what really good would look like, because that gives you parameters to work within, and you have a choice as a consultant when you're building in your solution. You also not only build them into your test script, but you build them into your design standards and your guiding principles. And if that's documented, and let's say you're working with an offshore team, for example, those design standards are absolutely fundamental in terms of building the guidelines around which you want them to code.
Mm. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead of you. Do you want to pick up on something, or
basically, was there ever a case where you had the requirements from someone and you found the solution, which is, I suppose, changes a little bit of the business process, and you know, you found a little bit of a conflict there, maybe you have a better solution, but it requires a little bit of a business change. How do you deal with that sort of conflict, I suppose?
Strip it back to the objectives and think about why the customer hired you in the first place. the customer, if they just wanted to lift and shift what they've already got, they wouldn't have hired a consultancy in. They could just get their own people to do that. Copy and paste into Salesforce, right? If they've hired a consultancy in, it's because they want to benefit from your experience of working with other customers. So I'm actually never afraid to do that. If it's going to change the business process, I go back and, you know, 90% of the time that's a value add for them, especially if you're working on a transformation project. If it's a transformation project, you actually want to be coming up with those changes. But if you're going to come up with changes like that, you also have to be able to communicate the pros, the cons, and the considerations and the impact that it has on other things. Because if it's a change to a business process, you've got to manage that through communication. You've also got to manage that through training, and you've got to educate other teams in case it has a knock-on effect on any of their processes. So you've got to think of the big picture and think about, do you know what I do? I go through my architect pyramid. I think, okay, who's going to need to see this? That's the sharing of visibility. How is the data going to be structured? That's my data architecture. How many records are involved? That's my data architecture. What's the integration pattern? Do people need to log into other systems? That's identity. Is there any community impact? That's community. You know, and just go through that, but then think primarily around the human beings as well, because, you know, it's easy for you to sit in a room full of managers who just go, I want it to do this, I want it to do that, I want it to do the other. And then you spend 6 months producing this platform and you're all really proud of it. And it's been a ball ache to get it done. And you're all like blood, sweat and tears have gone into it. And then the first week that it goes live, the users just go, I'm not using this, as rubbish. Right? We've all had those situations. Or you go in like a year later and someone screwed up all those beautiful dashboards that you made. You know, they've all changed the reports and they don't work anymore. You know, that I think is a knock-on effect of not designing around the user experience and with the user in mind. And this is why I think as consultants, our responsibility needs to extend beyond just gathering requirements and building solutions that fit them. You got to think about, is this going to be easy for someone to fill in? Is this going to be, you know, are there things that we can do to ramp people up with the system? Like, simple example, you could actually build some standard components, like for a new starter, start with just the detail page, then gradually pop in new related lists every other day, and they start to see this thing grow. And you can do that really easily with the technology, and it shows that you haven't just met the requirement, you've actually thought about the people involved and the future adoption of the system. Because if you haven't done that, I can guarantee you, oh, sorry, I'm on my soapbox lecturing, but I can guarantee you that they'll be back in 2 years saying, oh, we've got Salesforce, but we don't really use it to its full advantage.
Yeah, funny enough, I've just heard that in the last week. So yeah, let's not
always hear that.
let's not open that bucket, because I'm gonna go on a rant here.
Yeah. And a lot of the time, you know, there are many reasons for that. People come and go. People don't know what's been implemented and what decisions were made at the beginning. So, and they've come in and they've got something to prove. So they've got this fancy new job and they need to show their boss that they're worth it. So they'll come in and go, well, that's rubbish.
On that point, actually, how does, you know, what is basically the kind of user acceptance point, and what is the process from that? Because what I'm thinking is, and we'll kind of switch back at one point, because I do want to ask about, you know, the whole kind of sales support in terms of, you know, proof of concept, you know, that type of demo things, and how would you approach that? But I do want to kind of close kind of the loop in terms of at the end saying, okay, so we've developed something, we've tested it, and how do we leave the system, basically? How is it, you know, what is kind of the best approach in terms of your view? And what do we document, and how do we document it probably? Do we use some type of external, you know, is there a template, or how do you approach that?
Well, I think there are two things that need to be done here. One is to remember that if you're a consultant, you are in their org for all of 5 minutes compared to how long they've got to look after it for. So if you build solutions that are overcomplicated, you have to spend the time to document that and explain, you know, and that can mean these are the steps that you take to get the best out of this. This leads into that report, that leads into this report, et cetera, et cetera. I actually find also in your design standards, you should use Salesforce to document Salesforce. And the way you can do that, let's say in a formula field, for example, did you know you can use comments in formula fields? So if you've got a particularly nasty formula field that you've built, I actually put a line of comment in between each step that it does, just to say it's checking for this because of this business requirement. It's checking for that because of that business requirement. And then once we've got a return value on this formula, it kicks off a process flow. That's what your description boxes are all there for. But it's tedious and boring and no one wants to fill that stuff in. But once you've done it, you've done it. And just coming up and then documenting the process of documenting that in the org is really important. I suppose the other side of things for this is one is not over-engineering your solutions. The other is using Salesforce to document Salesforce. And the third is the mindset. Just don't forget that it's not your system. You might feel very precious about the way that you've designed something, but the best service you can do for a customer is to actually hold a peer review session. And what we used to do at Blue Wolf was a design review board. We used to get, so the project team, it would be the solution architect, technical architect, consultant, would put together a presentation and say, this is the requirement, and then these are the overall solutions that we intend to position. You present that back to a board of your peers and they have an opportunity to say, well, have you thought about this? What are the volumes for that? What's the security model for that? And it's not an approval gate. It's not a quality check per se. It's an opportunity. It's a learning opportunity, and it's an opportunity to benefit from experience of people, from a second pair of eyes, from people who are not in it. And at Blue Wolf, I both sat on a panel of peer reviewers. So I was a reviewer. But I also presented to a panel of my peers as well as a solution designer, and the collaboration that brings is just amazing. It's really, really cool.
Similar to a CTA review board, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Yeah, and it gets people in that mindset of, you know, actually justifying their ideas for it and the pros and cons. It shows that you have considered everything.
That's good.
With people about personal accounts, it was unbelievable. You don't want to use personal accounts because you can't switch them off afterwards. Well, that can't be the only reason that you've considered. Oh no, we didn't bother. You know, I used personal accounts in 2012 and they weren't very good, so I decided never to use them again. Well, that's not, you're doing a disservice to your customer then, because you're not considering everything.
Right? Yeah, well, it's the same thing that I've been user of this particular software whenever, you know, 10 years ago, so I'm not going to use it for the rest of my life. It's not really good, you know.
Salesforce is never finished.
It's never finished, no. On that point, I was going to say, kind of switch it back to kind of the beginning of these, is from a quote-unquote kind of sales support point of view, because, for example, when I worked at an ISV, what used to happen is, you know, you will have the package and then clients want different things, and then you kind of need to plan to customize that whenever it's deployed to their org and all of that. But there was a level of, oh, we need a demo for XYZ tomorrow. Can we do that?
Why?
Yeah. So my question there, to be honest, was whenever that needs to come about, either a demo or either, you know, providing support for example, public bids or, you know, kind of bidding. How would you approach that in terms of, do you potentially build proof of concepts, or you just spin up a dev org, a scratch org, and then, you know, you just conceptualize that or try to kind of, you know, pass that message over to the client, on the fly, basically?
No, I think, when it comes to Salesforce, one of the things that gets left behind quite often is planning on how the ownership will take shape. Because the tendency is to just, here's some money, here's your licenses, now get on with it. And then you end up with a system that stood up, but not really much idea of how it's going to be owned going forward. I mean, if I'm asked to do a demo, the first thing I'm going to want to know is, what are the biggest pains that you want Salesforce to ease for you, and then make sure that I, and also understand my audience, who's going to be in the room, what's their level of bias, find out as much as you can about their situation as well. Like, are they a decision maker? Are they an end user, etc.? Are there things that you can show them that are going to be appealing to them because they respond to the pains that they've got? With 24 hours notice, that's the point where I'm just like, okay, I need a call with you so that you can help me prepare. Otherwise, this 24 hours notice demo isn't going to happen, or at least it isn't going to be useful. And I'm just slightly going off here, but I do think that this could be a product of the world that we are in, where it's quite unforgiving and everybody wants everything yesterday and on demand. I would hope that this crisis might change some of that mindset and help people to value their A game a bit better, but also help people to be more mindful of their humanity as well. Especially in the consultancy world, there's so much riding on the shoulders of a consultancy, and so many dark consequences when stuff does go wrong. But also, as a consultant, you're going to be the first one who gets blamed for everything.
I've heard this a few days ago, reading this article, and someone said, "Oh yeah, you know, things are bad. The consultants are going to get blamed for this." And then someone said, "Well, you know, when there is change." The consultants are thriving, basically, because, you know, when change happens, then, you know, these guys are brought in to, you know, put in solutions or anything like that. So I guess they're kind of two sides of that coin, depending on how they look at it.
A lot of Salesforce projects fail because of mismatched expectations. Mm-hmm. And also, as well, there's an element of responsibility on the client. If the client hasn't made the right decisions because they haven't got the right people on the team or the right mindset, the right skill level on the team, that's the point where you need to raise that to your project manager and say, there's a risk. The risk is that Simon isn't coming to the meetings because Simon is busy doing other things. There's a risk because of his engagement level, at which point your project manager needs to know about that because they need to come up with strategy for handling it, because it directly affects the success of the project. And it might feel like you're throwing Simon under the bus a bit here, and you like him and you get on well with him, and, you know, he's very inspired by what you do. But, you know, it's okay to have those conversations and to say, you know what, I love Simon, really nice guy, maybe not the right person for this project. And, you know, sometimes the answer will come back and the project manager will just say, well, you know, we're stuck with them. You've just got to make the best you can with it. But then also, sometimes you're at the mercy of a project manager's mindset as well. Like, do I want to have that difficult conversation? So there's so much psychology involved in this job, loads of psychology. But I suppose it's having that, you're in a position to advise because you're a consultant. How you advise, I would recommend you think very carefully. Read books about communications, read books about emotional intelligence, for sure.
I don't know. We touched upon a bunch of things that I would really want to kind of get into more detail and stuff like that. But probably kind of my last question, or kind of my last point, was going to be in terms of, I don't know if there's anything, because you touched upon right now, in terms of, you know, you should probably look into communication, because, you know, that's basically, you know, kind of one of the best weapons that you can have in terms of, you know, being able to communicate properly at different levels and all of that. But my kind of last thing would be is, you know, is there anything else that you kind of deem as, quote unquote, kind of not really mandatory, but strongly encouraged for people that are trying to get into Salesforce consultancy, and potentially to consultancy in general, because, you know, you advise on Salesforce products or other companies' products. Would there be any areas that you think that these are strongly advised for people to develop in, because they're going to help them, you know, achieve kind of greater things in the career?
Yes, certainly there are podcasts, audio books, you know, physical books that you could look at. Soft skills are the ones that are ultimately going to help you the most. And there are some challenges as well that you get as a lady doing this. I'm just going to show you a book that was recommended to me, which I still need to read. Number one,
ooh.
Feminist Fight Club, an Office Survival Manual for a Sexist Workplace. So in a Salesforce, your knowledge is your currency, and there can sometimes be egos involved.
Mm.
And I have seen this and experienced this many, many times. And I've experienced it as someone who is young and someone who is female, especially if you're in a room full of blokes who all work in IT as well. And I'm very used to being in, I'm very used to commanding meeting rooms that are full of men. Yeah, for sure. And the way I handle it is to try and, remember that they're probably not doing it on purpose. But this book has helped me. You know, there's a lot of useful tips in this as well about having to, you know, knowing when to say no, you know, taking things to the boss, not covering for people. It's actually more of a comedy book than anything else, but there are a couple of little things that I've helped. You can see there's a couple of pages I've overturned Another one that's really good, this one was recommended to me, called The Way, It's The Way You Say It, Being Articulate, Well-Spoken and Clear. As you can see, I've not read that yet, but I will. And then this one, Crucial Conversations, Tools for Talking When the Stakes Are High. And this is all about, you know, sharing. How do you share your story? Emotions don't just happen. Notice which conditions are at risk. Silence and violence. Refuse the fool's choice. Focus on what you really want. You know, just really helps you to have important conversations. So I know they're books and things like that, but these are skills that come over time and they make you more valuable as a consultant. First of all, if you have empathy, if you can step into someone else's shoes and think about they're having this pain because and it's affecting their job, their job's at stake, right? So you can change your approach to be more understanding and helpful more than anything else. Classic example right now, you know, there's not many decisions being made because people are scared and uncertain. And if you show kindness and empathy to that, then you're more likely to get more out of someone when they're more engaged with you. So I suppose my biggest top tip there is remember your humanity. Try to tame it.
Good one. That's a good one. Okay.
Girls, don't be put off by men with their, you know, with everything out. Because
conversations, the weird conversations in the office.
Sure, because it is, you know, but remember, it's not a competition. Everybody's got different levels of knowledge in different things. And embracing the levels of knowledge and not feeling too protective over your solution and getting too personally attached. Be open to constructive criticism or feedback and value that feedback. Work on it, take it on board, and you'll be fine. The same goes for men too. Just be aware as well that it's women are particularly sensitive. The society at the moment is particularly sensitive to women in tech as well and minorities in tech. So we all have to become more self-aware of how we come across and cater our communication to it. I work on it every single day. And yeah, I make mistakes. I certainly have made mistakes. But the biggest mistakes you only make once, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing. You know, they kind of fall in the same bucket as with the embarrassing moment. You kind of, you know, first thing you have that, then you're going to remember to check your tie every time or so on. Yeah. Makes sense. I guess from my side, I was going to say thank you. Not sure if you want to say something else, but
Gemma, is there anything that you'd like for, you know, your listeners, your followers to know, you know, where to reach you and
Yes, please. Thanks for the opportunity. Obviously, now is a pretty bad time to start a business, I guess. But I would say that if you're in a position where you've got a project ahead of you and you can see some risks ahead, be it that you need to structure your head around requirements, you need to structure your head around how to engage with a customer, then myself and my team are making ourselves available to you to provide that support. We don't do implementation. We just sit alongside and we assist and we support, we mentor, we coach and we enable everybody who's involved in a project. Doesn't matter whether you're a customer or partner or Salesforce, we're very happy to be that bridge in between everybody else. So really we're just trying to make people aware that we're here, that we're here to help, and that the key differentiator for us is that there is nothing that's out of scope either. So, you know, if you want a successful project, you can get in touch with me. I am very happy to text, use Twitter, use email, whatever. So
what's your Twitter handle?
GemziBeth, GemziBeth.
That's great. And guys, don't forget about the ladies be architects. That's the one and only.
Yep. That's our active learning and certification nonprofit.
Okay, that was revealing to say the least. During the conversation, I found myself wanting to make notes a few times. So many pearls of wisdom there from Gemma. As you probably realize, we did have a bunch of other questions, but have been restrained by time. So we hope you've enjoyed this conversation. And if you haven't, or you have a suggestion, feel free to drop us an email at podcastguest@sfdcconsultant.com. Until next time, take care.